5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
I'm Hannah.
I'm Saruti.
And this is Red Handed. Welcome to episode 22. We would like to jump right in with our five-star review. Thank yous.
So DGI297, informative and entertaining, says that they listen to many podcasts of this genre, but this is the best of them all. It's well-researched, humorous and sweary, but still sensitive to all victims. Thank you. Sounds like a robot, but yes. Is that a bot? Have you left? We don't get them to capture anything, so could be a bot. But if not, thank you.
I've got another one from, I couldn't find the name you left the review under, but I know your real name is Nicola because you work with my mum at the GP surgery. And she'd never listened to a podcast before, and she thinks it's just the right amount of swearing. So welcome to the podcast universe, Nicola.
And then we also want to now thank all of our Patreons, because you guys have been amazing. We've had so many more of you come on board since we recorded the last episode, and Hannah and I set the goal of getting to $150 a month, and we would do a live episode with Q&A where you could ask us anything. I rather, you know, flippantly put that out there to Hannah that we should do it because it would take us ages to get there and we'd have loads of times to figure out exactly how we do a live episode. And then you guys are getting us dangerously close to that point. So we're going to have to figure that out probably this week.
Yeah, we're going to have to do one. I genuinely have no idea.
We'll figure it out before we get there, I'm sure. Unless you guys keep going at this speed, in which case we might not. But want to thank Hey Why The Face, we see you, Sarah, and Jill Foster, Vicky, Sydney Smith, Shona Ray,
Alison Ernst, Linda Cardinal, yeah. I'm going to say, Nicole Shepherd, Mandy Baxter and Lydia Campbell. And we've got one more five-star review. Thank you, which is from Rough Giraffe, who I think actually do their own podcast. Have I got that wrong?
They do. They do their own podcast. Yes, you guys should check them out. Part of the hashtag Britpod scene.
They say, the chemistry is great and we're funny without being disrespectful to the story. Highly recommend, hands down brilliant, which is high praise.
I absolutely love this week's social media moment of the week. It's been one of my favorites that we've had for a long time, and it's from A Dancer Day 17, that's the Twitter handle, who called us out on the mispronunciation of the town Tomodden. I still don't know how to say it properly.
I still don't understand it.
But I felt like how they said we should say it is how I thought we had said it.
It's a mystery.
They were kind enough to send us a link on Twitter, which is a guide on how to pronounce northern towns, which really entertained us because I'm not sure if it's a he or a she, but they called us Southern Softies and they said, you Southern Softies don't know how to pronounce Northern English names. And I guess you're right, we don't. Thank you, everyone. Patreons, keep them coming. Reviews, please keep them coming. And social media, we love it. So guys, so today we are telling you the story of how an adopted child on the hunt for her birth parents helped to solve a 32-year-old cold case. Now this is a twisty-turny one, as loads of names, so be it warned. On the 10th of November, 1985, a hunter was out walking through the woods in Bear Brook National Park in New Hampshire, and he found, on this walk, on his hunt, a 55-gallon barrel. Something possessed him, and I don't know what, because I wouldn't do this, to look inside this barrel. And inside, unsurprisingly, because this is why I wouldn't look, he found two dismembered bodies wrapped in plastic. I mean, what else were you expecting to see in there? I'd almost be like, oh yeah, there it is. That's exactly what I thought I'd find.
I just don't understand why you would look inside. Because it had a lid on too. It wasn't just like open. So he opened it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's like he went through quite a bit of effort to look inside those barrels. Don't look in barrels that aren't yours. Even if they are yours. Someone else could have put a body in them in the time you weren't looking at them.
How many barrels do you have?
So don't look in barrels, basically. But the bodies that were in there were that of an adult woman, estimated to be between 23 and 33 years old, and a child that could have been anywhere between 5 years and 11 years old. Now, the police were able to prove via DNA analysis that the pair in the barrel were mother and daughter. Both were killed by blunt force trauma to the head, but they have never been identified. And due to the rate of decomposition of the bodies, it was impossible to ascertain the time of death or have any idea as to how long the bodies had actually even been in there. And we know, if you've listened to the Costume Cupboard Corpse episode, when a body is enclosed, the decomposition process happens at a very different rate and very differently, and makes identification of the body and the time of death hard, if not basically impossible to accurately pinpoint.
So with absolutely no leads, the Bear Brook murder case remained open.
So as late as 2000.
So this is only 17 years ago, and it's 32 years after the original barrel was found. The case was assigned a new detective team, and the crime scene was re-examined, and they found another barrel with two more bodies in it. And this time, the bodies were both small girls. One was between 2 and 4, the other was between 1 and 3 years old. They had also been killed in the same way as the mother and daughter, so blunt force trauma to the head. So yeah, the same way as the mother and daughter in the barrel found in 1985. The police are almost certain these bodies were killed at the same time as those found 15 years before. And they were right. 3 out of the 4 bodies in the barrels were related.
That's crazy.
The youngest child was related to the first 2 bodies in the first barrel. She was also the daughter of the adult woman in the 1985 barrel and the sister of the 9 to 11 year old. So it was a mother and 2 children who had been killed in the same way, at the same time, and disposed of in this awful way. But strangely, the child in the second barrel, the child who was between 2 and 4 years old, was found to be absolutely no relation to the other bodies. It did appear that the 4 victims were killed at around the same time. However, the police just couldn't identify the bodies. So essentially, a family of 4 had not been reported missing at any juncture between 1985 and 2000.
That's so strange to me.
It is, isn't it? So it's literally a woman and 3 girls. It's as if they never existed, like nobody missed them.
That's what's so bizarre, because yes, sometimes when you come across these cases, when it's someone who is quite transient or not connected to their family in some way goes missing and no one reports them, it makes sense. But a family of 4 go missing, mother, children, and nobody notices that they've gone. That's so odd. You know, the police did the best that they could at the start with this case. It was a difficult one, but they put together forensic reconstructions, and these were sent out all over New Hampshire, but no one recognised them. And I don't know how much that surprises me, because firstly, they weren't great. And we've spoken about this before in previous episodes. We're not sure that either of us would be able to recognise someone from a forensic reconstruction.
Like, I honestly think if someone did a forensic reconstruction of you, I'm, like, unsure I would be able to be, like, that Saruti.
I mean, it is an art, and I do appreciate how they do it. It's really interesting how they build the face up. But they just don't seem to be that effective.
They never are. They just always look, like, super generic.
Yeah, and, you know, that must have been the case here. But then saying that, no one even reported them missing. So how closely connected was anyone to them? In any case, nobody recognised it. But in October 2016, DNA tests revealed that the 3 related victims were all of Native American descent, and the one who wasn't related was from the Wisconsin area. But one of the children also exhibited signs of pneumonia. Could this have been evidence of some sort of transient lifestyle?
I think that kind of explains why nobody missed them.
I was going to say, is that why nobody reported them missing or was able to identify them? Basically, remember this one, put a pin in it, because we're going to come back to it, and it will all become clear as we go. So we're going to start with a different story. So in the summer of 1986, a 5-year-old, who we'll call Lisa, showed up at a trailer park in Scotts Valley, California. She slept in the back of a pickup truck under a camper shell with her father, Gordon Jensen. What is a camper shell?
I had to look up what a camper shell was. It basically can turn your truck into a caravan. It's just this like thing you put on the back of a pickup truck and it encloses it and makes it like a house. In my head I had like this like tarpaulin thing, but it's not that at all. It's like a metal thing you put on the back of a truck and it makes it into like a
Cool, that's pretty handy. So they were living basically in this pickup truck under this camper shell. It's almost like put up a little convertible hood over your pickup truck.
Yeah, it's like that. Yeah.
So Jensen was an electrician and a general handyman, and while he worked, little Lisa would go next door to Catherine Decker's trailer, where Lisa would spend hours playing with Catherine's grandson. Lisa's father told Decker that his wife had died when Lisa was a baby and that he was really struggling to bring Lisa up alone. Now, as time wore on, Decker felt more and more sorry for Lisa. After all, no child should have to live like that, just living out of the back of a truck and basically, while her father works all day, just finding things to do on the streets, and just being lucky enough that Decker lives next door and is a kind person.
Yeah, it's really sad. Like, all of the descriptions of her when she's that young is like just looking a bit grubby, not really having proper clothes, which is like, it's just really sad. Like, no kid should have to live out of a car. So one morning, Gordon Jensen knocks on the Decker's door and he said that he thought it might be best for Lisa to go and live with Catherine Decker's daughter. Initially, on a 3-week trial, and if that went well, an adoption could be drawn up.
Did he even know Decker's daughter?
I think she must have been around because Lisa played with her son, I think.
Okay, yeah, of course.
But I don't think they were in the trailer park for that long, so he must have met her maybe a handful of times. But he knows the grandmother, he knows Catherine Decker-ish. Yeah. Decker was completely ecstatic with this news because she really wanted another grandchild and she loved Lisa. So she went straight out and bought Lisa new clothes and new shoes for her move to her new house. And this is really, really like hurts me. Lisa was so excited that she slept in her new shoes.
Ugh.
She couldn't take them off. And the next day, Catherine Decker drove Lisa to Chino Hills to her daughter's house, which was 6 hours away. Her daughter did live in an actual house, not a trailer park. Just putting that in there. No shade against trailer parks, I'm sure they're fine. The trial 3 weeks went incredibly well, and excitedly, the Deckers returned to the trailer park to move forward with the official adoption. But Gordon Jensen was nowhere to be found. He had abandoned his child, and Lisa would never see him again. I do wonder, though, I would assume that Catherine Decker is in touch with her daughter who lives 6 hours away. How did she not notice that he was gone? If her trailer's right next door to his truck.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I don't know. It's really weird. Unless, I don't know, she just thinks he's out for work. Now that Lisa's not there, he's able to do more, like, go places to work. I don't know. Very, very
That's
odd.
The only thing I could think of was that maybe Catherine, obviously he would come and, maybe he came and went quite a lot and then she just...
Yeah, just didn't notice. Yeah.
But even more concerning were the things that Lisa was saying about her father to the Deckers. They were so concerned that they began to suspect that Lisa had been molested by Gordon Jensen, and they alerted the police. The police interviewed Lisa, and they too became convinced that she had been sexually abused. And as a result, the police took her from the Deckers and placed her in state custody. The Deckers and Lisa were never reunited. This also confused me because I don't understand why this family happily would have taken her. They clearly love her. Why was she then put into the state system?
I know. I do think it's really sad. They did everything right. They took this child in. They did the 3-week trial period as the father had requested. They even took it straight to the police as soon as they had suspicions and concerns about what may have been happening to Lisa before they got her. But at the same time, remember, they never actually officially passed over adoption papers, anything like that. There was no actual record apart from their anecdotal evidence as to what had happened and how they had happened upon this child.
Yeah, that's true.
The police just have to take their word for it that they took this child away from this man who had given her to them and then disappeared. They don't actually know anything. It really is sad, but I think probably just in the best interests of Lisa, taking her away.
The police also questioned Lisa about where she came from because she's just this wastrel. She just turns up out in the middle of nowhere and is abandoned. And Lisa told the police that she had brothers and sisters, but they had all died from eating grass mushrooms whilst they were camping. Which is, that's weird. Like, how
I don't have any idea what that means. It's very odd.
Why would all of her brothers and sisters, and not her dad, why were they all eating different things? That makes no sense. Like, I'm calling it. That didn't happen.
No, I mean, it's not even the fact that they'd be eating different things. Like, what is she talking about? When camping and all my brothers and sisters died from eating grass mushrooms. No, but then there is just such, and this will become more and more obvious as we go through this case, actually, is just how much of a mystery Lisa is and how little anyone knew anything about her at this point.
The police, concerned by the grass mushroom story and by the potential sexual abuse allegations, they scoured the trailer park for anything that can lead them to Gordon Jensen. Finally, the police found a single fingerprint on a hi-fi system that he had installed. This fingerprint ran a match for a man called Curtis Mayo Kimball, who had been arrested in Cypress, California for a DUI in 1985, in May. Cypress is over 400 miles from Scotts Valley, and when Curtis Kimball was arrested, he had a young daughter in the car with him. So Lisa's father, Gordon Jensen, was not who he said he was. But it is so, so much more complicated than that. It's not just a fake name to escape a conviction.
Oh no. In 1988, the man who called himself Gordon Jensen and Curtis Kimball was pulled over by the police again in San Luis Obispo. He was driving a stolen car and using yet another fake name. This time, it was Jerry Mockerman.
I feel like that's a bad fake name.
It is a bad fake name. It was like when we did the Bible John one, and it was like John Templeton. John Templeton. Yeah. Jerry Mockerman. Maybe it's a double bluff.
Yeah, maybe.
But anyway, during this arrest, Jerry Mockerman was fingerprinted and identified as the same man who had abandoned Lisa Jensen in the Scotts Valley trailer park 2 years before. And he was taken to trial. Astonishingly, the charges of child molestation were dropped. And guess why? You got it. Our favourite, a plea deal.
Vomit. I hate them. I hate them so much. I hate bail. I hate plea deals.
I guess at least they caught this guy. They took him to trial on, the charges of child abandonment. So Jensen, Kimball, Mockerman, whatever we want to call him, pled guilty to child abandonment and he was given 3 years in prison. The authorities at this point, though, still had no idea what this man's real name was. They don't know his date of birth or where he came from, and he isn't giving anything away. He served 19 months, and the second he was released in 1990, guess what? He violated his parole, skipped town, and disappeared. Now, until 2002, he managed to keep a low profile in Richmond, California, using yet another alias, Larry Vanna. As we did with Billy Joe Jenkins' case in the overuse of the word clarinet. In this episode, we could probably be playing a fake name drinking game right now, but it is about 12 o'clock in the afternoon on a Sunday and we'd be absolutely trashed if we were playing that.
I feel like I'm still a bit trashed from last night, if I'm honest.
But when Larry Vanna arrived in Richmond, California, he was homeless, but he picked up odd jobs. I guess he was an electrician. There's always a need for that. And eventually moved into the back room of a supermarket. Now, the locals remember him being 6 foot tall with piercing blue eyes and one hell of a drinking problem. So, but how exactly was this man keeping a low profile? A 6 foot tall, piercing blue eyed alcoholic?
Well, he didn't get arrested for anything. He was just, you know, picking up odd jobs, not really getting in anyone's way. The supermarket he lived in, he'd like done a job for them. He'd like refinished their floor or something. And he was just like, can I live here?
Oh, that's, yeah, interesting. But in 2001, he married a woman named Yunsen Jun. And shortly after, he moved into her home. Now the next year, guess what? Yunsen Jun disappeared without a trace. Now veteran cold case cracker Roxanne Grunheide was put on this case. When she interviewed the man of many names, he remained calm and collected, patiently explaining that his wife was in fact living in Oregon, receiving psychiatric treatment. He even recited her doctor's phone number by heart and volunteered to have his fingerprints taken. But of course the fingerprints proved that he was Curtis Kimball, or Jeremy Mockerman, or by default, Gordon Jensen. So Grunheide arrested this mystery man for parole violation and went to search Yunsen Jun's house, where the couple had been living together just a few months before their backyard wedding.
And strap in, guys, brace yourselves, because this is where it starts to get pretty fucking dark. Grünheide and her team made a gruesome discovery at the house. In the basement, they discovered an enormous pile of cat litter, and under this pile was the partially dismembered body of Yunsun Jun. She had been killed by blunt force trauma to the head months before they discovered her body, and that must have been what the cat litter was for, to absorb the smell of this rotting body under the house. Because cat litter is really good at sucking moisture out of things. It's actually better than rice when your phone goes for a little swim in the toilet, as mine has done sometimes.
Top tip.
It is a top tip, cat litter. Grünheide was certain that this murder was too calculated, too cold to be the man with many names first kill, and she vowed to prove it. It does seem, if it's your first kill, partial dismemberment, I could sort of buy. I don't think you'd keep it in your house if it was your first kill.
But then, you know, people do kill their spouses. But then I guess, come on, you arrest this guy, he's already on parole violation, then his new wife turns up dead, and all the lying, and like, oh, you know, she's having psychiatric treatment in Oregon, she's not dead, she's just vanished. No, she's not vanished or dead, I know exactly where she is. Like, it's all of those things put together that really make it seem like this is not a man who was killed for the first time.
So, going on her hunch, Grünheide started with Lisa Jensen, the little girl who'd been abandoned in the trailer park 15 years before. She found that the mystery man had reported many conflicting stories about the cause of his wife's death. In the police records, it stated that she's died during childbirth, she's died of cancer, she's been shot, or she died in a car crash. Like, he gives different stories depending on whoever he's speaking to. And no death certificate ever surfaced. Neither did Lisa's birth certificate. And still, Grünheide and her team had absolutely no idea who this man really was. But Grünheide was convinced that whoever this guy was, there was absolutely no way he was Lisa's father. And she found in the old police records that Lisa's blood had been taken for a paternity test, but it had never been carried out. Can you imagine working your heart out on a case? And then you're like, oh my God, amazing, there's a paternity test. And then you find out that it was just never done.
That's crazy.
The mystery man, at this particular time, I think he was going by the name of, it was Larry Vanner. The mystery man was found guilty of the murder of Yunsun Jun and was sentenced to 15 years to life in June 2003. But even with him behind bars, Grünheide stayed on the case. Months after he was put away, Grünheide proved via a DNA test that she had been right all along and the man of many names was not Lisa's biological father. This meant that Lisa Jensen's case was no longer child abandonment. It was an abduction. When questioned, the mystery man had absolutely no memory of Lisa at all, and right up to his death in prison in 2010, he gave nothing away. Whoever he really was, whatever his real name, he took it to his grave. We'll never know. And that's what I think is so interesting about this case, and it'll become clearer as we go on. But this guy is a mystery. Nobody knows. Nobody knows where he came from. And I just find it a really bizarre idea that you can live like that. That people can just appear from nowhere. So what had happened to Lisa Jensen before she showed up at the Scotts Valley trailer park that summer in 1986 remained a total mystery. She genuinely could have been taken from anywhere. Peter Headley, the deputy of the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department, felt that the case was next to impossible to solve. They didn't even have a geographic area to start them off. And as for the mystery man of many names, they had no idea who he was, even stating, this guy is a ghost, and referring to Lisa as a living Jane Doe. And that's really chilling.
It's horrifying. And of course, rightly so, as you can only imagine. While all this is happening, Lisa never stopped wondering where she came from, who she really was. And after she had been taken from the Deckers at age 5, she was adopted by a loving family and grew up just outside of Los Angeles, but those questions would never really go away. And in 2015, Lisa decided to find out who her parents were and bought a DNA kit from Ancestry.com.
You know, I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
You know the website that pops up on ads and is like, are you related to a king? Isn't it always funny when people are like, oh, I used to be a Chinese princess, when they do those past life regressions, and it's always, oh, I was related to William the Conqueror or a king.
Yeah, no one's ever like a peasant, are they?
I'm from peasant stock. No one's ever that.
I read that, obviously, the farther you go back, I think everyone of like Caucasian European descent, if you go back far enough, is a relation of Charlemagne, just because the sheer amount of people who would potentially be in your family tree exceeds the amount of people who have ever lived ever.
Oh yeah, and there's the number of people of Asian and like Eastern descent, and the crazy high percentage of men of that descent, particularly who are related to Genghis Khan. I was just trying to look it up while you were speaking, but I can't remember. It's something insane though. Like,
yeah, because Genghis Khan was like a mad shagger. He shagged everyone. Yeah. He had like hundreds of children.
Yeah, so it basically says here that the Y chromosome lineage present in about 8% of men in the region of Asia stretching from northeast China to Uzbekistan, which is about 0.5% of the total world population, which is equivalent to about 16 million men at the time of this data's publication would be directly descended from Genghis Khan.
That's insane.
There's an article that I read about him when I was reading about this, and I can't remember. I think it was like The Guardian or something. And it was like, calls him like a fucking Lothario or like a Playboy or Romeo. I was like, he was a fucking rapist. He wasn't going around like dating and courting all these women and like taking them out and making them fall in love with him so he could plant his seed in them and sow his wild oats. What the fuck? Don't call him Romeo or whatever stupid thing they called him. If I find it, I'll post it on the Facebook group. What a moronic thing to call him. He raped and pillaged his way across the world. And that's why so many people are related to him. Not because he was one hell of a guy, real top bloke. And that's why all these women fell for him.
I've literally just had like a flash of what if Genghis Khan was a competitor on The Bachelor.
Oh my god, yeah. Can you imagine? That's great. Or like, what's that horrible show that's on ITV?
Oh, Take Me Out.
Take Me Out. You just see him come down the lift. Apparently, according to this article, all of those women would have left their light on for him. But I don't think that's what was happening. Anyway.
Oh, what a Lothario. Oh, hi, Casanova. Dear. Oh, my God.
Absolute revisionist history right there. Thank you, Guardian. I might be slandering them. It might not be them. I will find the article. So anyway, this DNA kit, which I can understand more so than like a regular person doing it. Lisa wanted to do it not to see if she was related to Charlemagne, but in fact, what her actual lineage was and where she was from. I can imagine the people who don't have that, why that question would never go away from them and why they would need to know the answer. So the DNA test comes and it works by you spitting in a tube, you send it off, they analyze it and they search their existing database for matches. So obviously it is really limited. Not everyone is going to be on the database and only people who have agreed to be in there will be in there. But it is a good start and the results come back. And in fact, Lisa's DNA was a very close match with that of an 81-year-old man living on the West Coast who was of Canadian descent. Now, the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department had also had a team working on Lisa's ancestry, and they determined that this man on the West Coast must share a common female relative, and to find out who this was, they needed to be able to identify more relations. So Lisa sent off DNA samples to more genealogy websites. One came back with another match, a 42-year-old man living in San Francisco named Adam Keim. Now, Barbara Ray Venter, who was a volunteer working on Lisa's family, wrote to Keim and told him that she believed he was a cousin of a child who had been abducted, who now wanted to know where she came from.
But unfortunately, Keim had no answers because he himself had been adopted as a baby. He had sent his DNA off to the genealogy website's database for the same reason as Lisa. He wanted to find his biological family. So Barbara Rae Venter promised Keim that in return for his help with Lisa, she would locate his birth parents too. With that, Keim agreed to share copies of the closest matches he had received on the various ancestry websites. And he also knew his mother's original surname and the date he was born in San Diego. So that's enormous help. That's way more than Lisa has. And Rae Venter found Adam Keim's birth name by searching California birth records. And she found a brother that Adam didn't know he had. And just months later, they were able to locate his birth mother living just hours away. And the information that Adam Keim had shared with Rae Venter and the team working on Lisa's lineage meant that they were able to prove that the 81-year-old man living on the East Coast was related to both Adam and Lisa. This 81-year-old man was their grandfather, and he had an astonishing 18 children. So now, the team working on Lisa's case, they can focus their search a little bit, but it's still an enormous task to get through. I mean, if you think about it, so he's got 18 children. What if they have 3 children each, and this is a generation back? So it's just an enormous amount of people. But undeterred, the team set about tracing each one of these 18 children and building a family tree, searching for any living relative who could provide DNA that could help them. And eventually it was established that Lisa was descended from a line of French Canadians who had settled in New Hampshire. And they found an obituary for one of her relatives, a Georgette Bowden, who had died in 2008. Survived by her only daughter, Denise. But when looking for anything on Denise, whether she was still alive or where she lived, nothing could be found. So the trail went cold. And Denise was the only woman who could have been Lisa's mother. Denise had gone missing in 1981 from her home in Manchester, New Hampshire. She had vanished after a Thanksgiving dinner with her parents. Her 6-month-old daughter and her boyfriend, who is a man called Bob Evans, and Denise were never seen again. This has to be Lisa, the 6-month-old daughter who goes missing after Thanksgiving has to be Lisa. And Lisa's birth name was Dawn Bowden. They found her birth certificate, and Lisa finally found out when her birthday was. I hadn't even thought, until researching this one, I'd never even thought about not knowing when your birthday is.
Poor Lisa. Everything that happened, but just having absolutely no idea what her name was. Lisa was just the name. This guy, whatever had happened, whoever she ended up with, this Jensen, quote-unquote Jensen guy, could have just been what he called her. To not know what your parents called you, that's just so sad.
And actually, when Lisa found this out, when she found out that her real name was Dawn, she was speaking to the people working on her case and she was like, what do? I change my name?
Oh, that's so sad.
I know, isn't it? So, the San Bernardino Sheriff's Department dug out a mugshot of this Bob Evans who had gone missing with Denise from 1980 because he had been arrested for numerous petty crimes, including diverting electrical currents in order to steal it. I'd never thought of stealing electricity. But this guy, Bob Evans, was an electrician by trade. And they compared the mugshot to the man who abandoned Lisa in the Scotts Valley trailer park in 1986. And you guessed it, it's the same fucking guy.
But there's even more to come, because remember the unsolved Allenstown Bear Brook murders? They happened to be in the same area of New Hampshire, just 15 miles away from Manchester, where the man with many names had been living with Denise before she went missing. Also remember that 2 of the bodies in the barrels had been partially dismembered, just like Yunsen Jun. And Grunheid was certain that Yunsen Jun was not this man's first kill. And the DNA proved that the mystery man of many names was the father of the child in the barrel that was not related to the other victims. So whether he killed them or not, he was the father.
This is really bizarre.
Yeah.
So there's the mother and the 2 children that are hers.
And then there's the unrelated child who is now his child.
Exactly, yeah.
And they were the ones that were all dead and in the barrels. But the woman in the barrel was not Denise. It wasn't Lisa's birth mother. It was someone else entirely. Now this man, he absolutely fits the profile of a serial killer. Just traipsing around the country, living this transient lifestyle. He's a drifter killer. Just wanders around.
If Denise was in the barrel, it would kind of tie it up with a really nice bow, wouldn't it? Like it would just be a complete case. Yeah. But that's not what it is. There, it's a completely different set of people.
Absolutely.
That potentially had nothing to do with Lisa at all.
This is the thing that's so weird. He disappears with Denise when Lisa is 6 months old. All three of them go missing. Then they're completely off the radar. Then he's with Lisa in this trailer park when she's, what, 5 or 6? Which is when they run into the Deckers. But in that time, that barrel of bodies has been found, which contains a woman that isn't Denise, so isn't Lisa's mother, two of her children, and this guy, Jensen's child. But he's out there in this trailer park with a 5 or 6 year old Lisa, who isn't his child. And Denise is nowhere to be seen. So in that time, Denise has gone missing. He's been with another woman. And who's the mother of that child? Because it wasn't the other woman in the barrel. It's just so bizarre. He's an absolute drifter killer, which is why he was able to get away with this for so long. Changing his name, transient lifestyle. He had a job that allowed him to kind of just move from town to town doing odd jobs. He had this drinking problem. He's just such an archetype of a serial killer. But there were murmurs also that he may have even been a military man at some point. But I don't know how much stock I put in that, because literally no one knows anything about this guy.
Yeah, like when I read that, I was like, you can't know
that. And also,
that.
If he was in the military, there would have been a paper trail. His details would have been on profile. His DNA, his fingerprints, all of that would have been in part of the government database. They would have been able to identify him sooner. But it seems that what is so strange about this man is not just how much of a mystery he is, but that literally anyone he touches just goes missing. Could the family that were in the barrels, as we said, just be another one of these wives that he killed? Lisa said, remember, that she had brothers and sisters who had died, but there was only female bodies in the barrels, and we know that this woman was not her mother. Because, so she said she had brothers and sisters. Where were the brothers? What was going on? It's all a bit Mick Philpotty, don't you think?
Oh, it completely is. It's so confusing. And also, you've got to remember, what the police are going on is the testimony of a 5-year-old girl who's suffered abuse. You know, it's not going to be necessarily the clearest thing to follow. I mean, it's hard to get a straight answer out of a child at the best of times. So it's quite difficult to know what you can trust and what you can't. But I genuinely am astonished that, and I guess that maybe it's something we don't have a grasp on in this country, because comparatively the UK is peanuts compared to the size of the United States. But I'm always fascinated by the idea that people can just disappear and reappear, and the crossing of state lines playing such a major role in whether you can be caught or not.
They have crazy rules on the way jurisdiction works across state lines, things like that, and the lack of kind of information sharing. We even have that here, the lack of information sharing between different counties and how much they're willing to tell other police forces. It's weird, and it is an absolute failing in the majority of law enforcement when that doesn't happen properly.
If hypothetically the man with many names did kill the family in the barrel,
I think yes.
We have no way of knowing whether it happened before or after he abandoned Lisa with the Deckers. I think it was probably before.
Yeah.
I don't think it could have been after. I think he skips town, he goes and does something else. I think, I don't know whether Lisa was there, though. That's something I can't square in my mind. I don't know whether she was, like, the saved one, you know?
Well, I think it was before, because, you know, she is aware of having had other people, like other siblings, even though they weren't related to her in her life. And I think she was just the one that ended up escaping that death, or that mass
murder. But I don't think the people in the barrels are the brothers and sisters that Lisa's talking about.
I think there are more, but I think that he was with these people because his own child was there. Why would he have left his child somewhere else with this woman, taken Lisa to go be in a trailer park, come back, kill them, and then abandon her with the Deckers? I mean, I have no real logic. There isn't any information that we can absolutely say this was the timeline. And I don't know how important it is. At some point, I think he definitely killed the people that were in the barrels. There's just too much of a close link to him. They died from blunt force trauma to their head. They were dismembered. It fits with his MO of what he was doing. And
I definitely think that he did kill the people who were in the barrels. Whether Lisa knew them or not, I'm not sure.
Fair. We don't know. We don't know that. But she was with him from the age of 6 months old. She disappeared with him and Denise when she was 6 months old. And then she's still with him at 5 or 6. I don't know, I feel like if he kills Denise immediately after, he keeps Lisa. Either one of two reasons, or three reasons. I don't know how much I believe the first one. that he has some empathy or some compassion for this child. He kills the mother, but he decides to keep Lisa alive. I don't know. He doesn't seem to be a man who is filled with that kind of sentiment. Point two, it could be it gives him an air of credibility. You have a child with you. People are going to ask fewer questions, maybe even give you more sympathy, give you more leeway than if you're just a solo rogue man on his own. Or third reason, he was sexually abusing her. And that's why he kept her.
I did think about that, which is just, it's horrific, isn't it?
It is horrific, but I feel like those are the only, that's what I mean though. I think that after maybe he kills Denise, he finds this other woman and he somehow has a baby with somebody else. These are the two other kids that are hers. He kills them all, leaves with Lisa. I think Lisa would have known them because she, like I said, she was with him from 6 months to 5 years. And if we say that this happened before he abandoned Lisa, then she must have known them.
But then why is the kid that is Jensen's son, daughter even, I could understand if all of the children in the barrels were related to the mother, but they're not.
No.
One of them is his and has nothing to do with her. So they've got this weird merged family of all of these kids.
That would have been the case with Lisa as well, that he was with Denise. Lisa's not even his. So he meets Denise when she has this baby. He takes them on. They disappear together. I think Denise is probably dead. And then he moves on to this other woman. He brings a child in with him, probably tells her that Lisa's his. Then maybe he fathers a child with some other woman. I don't know. It's all very odd. But, you know, they're not living a nuclear family life. Like, they have some
sort
of weird...
No, they're not. But I wonder, with his sort of transient lifestyle, it's odd that he would father a child and then take it with him. It seems odd that just because the lifestyle he was living, you would think that if he's fathering a child with a woman that he's not with, it just seems very unlikely to me that he would take the kid.
No, I know. I don't know why that child was there that was his and why that child was dead in the barrel.
And the deaths of the barrel bodies are thought to have taken place in the early 80s when Denise was living with this man in 1981. They went missing in 1981. What I wonder, though, where is Denise?
I think she's
dead. Because she's not in the barrels. No, she's dead, but where is she?
Oh, I don't know.
And then if we don't know where Denise is, like, there could be countless... Because, I mean, he's got form, hasn't he? Like, he's killed at least three women.
There's no way that Denise is alive. But she could be anywhere between being under a pile of cat litter somewhere or being in a barrel, partially dismembered. Like, she could be anywhere. He was so transient. Who knows what he did?
I do wonder whether barrels was his, like, choice method of disposal. Like, are there, I mean, potentially, however many barrels full of bodies, because like, I think they've tracked him in at least 11 states using about 15 different names. So there could be hundreds.
She could be anywhere. She could be absolutely anywhere. And you know that those barrels were found in a national park. There's countless acres and acres and acres of America that is just covered in national parks. Like, who knows? She could be absolutely anywhere. She doesn't even need to be in a barrel. She could just be in a shallow grave somewhere. Denise is definitely dead.
Oh, she's dead. What I wonder with Lisa, it is funny though, of like, why was Lisa spared? Because, I mean, Lisa says that she thinks that this man spared her because he believed her to be his child. But he killed a child who was 100% his child. So I don't think I buy that either.
I don't
buy that. So I think, I mean, as horrible as it is, I think you're right. I think he kept her because he was sexually abusing her, because he was raping her.
Yeah, I think having one child would give him that kind of, like I said, maybe a bit of credibility, no questions asked. If there's a guy living next to you, next door, maybe you watch him a bit closer if he's doing anything odd. But if he has a child, it's like, oh, he's just a struggling father trying to get by with his child. I think maybe the reason the other child was dead was because maybe Lisa just fitted with the sexual abuse side, fitted more into his, into his type of what he wanted.
But then what I wonder, why did he give her up then?
I think it probably got to a point where the pressure was building. Maybe I don't want to take this child with me anymore. And maybe, to be absolutely horrific, she was no longer fitting into his preferred age group.
But then why wouldn't he just kill her, like the rest of them? That's what doesn't make sense.
The Deckers had seen her a lot and, you know, she played around there all the time. And he thought, you know, the daughter lives 6 hours away. Go take her for a 3-week trial. I'll disappear. How would you, like, don't need to kill her. Let's just get get rid of her this way. I'm done. I'm out. A small shred of humanity through his own convenience at that point, probably. But I think don't be in any doubt that if there had been no convenient way to get rid of Lisa, that he absolutely wouldn't have hesitated to kill her. I don't think.
No, I think you're right. And actually, earlier this year, so 2017, the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department announced that they believed that the man with many names, who they call Bob Evans, was responsible for at least 6 murders. So that's Yun Sun Jun, the 4 bodies in the barrels found in Bear Brook National Park, and Denise Bowden.
Absolutely. And I wonder how many more there actually are out there. But we'll never know.
There has to be. There has to be more. That can't be it.
But how traumatic for poor Dawn, to use her actual name that her mother named her. We'll never know really what happened to her, but it's such a sad case. That's the story of how Ancestry.com helped solve a decades-old murder.
32 years, cold case.
It is a cold case, yeah. And actually, with the title of this episode, like I said, and the case that we've covered here, we've done them a solid in terms of PR, but I'm going to do a little bit to tear that down in a special mini video / audio for Patreons this week that I'm going to record later today. We'll put it out at some point next week. And it's about the use or misuse of familial DNA testing by law enforcement. Now, if you're not familiar with it, the running a familial DNA search is a technique that allows investigators to identify suspects who don't have DNA in a law enforcement database, but whose close relatives have had their genetic profiles catalogued. And how are these profiles being catalogued? Well, through the boom in the private sector of collecting masses of our DNA through companies such as Ancestry.com. And what we're going to talk about in this is the kind of dangers that could arise from their misuse. And I'll cover a couple of cases in which this idea of kind of familial DNA search testing has led to definitely some miscarriages of justice.
That's terrifying. But I do think, though, if you're obviously things like Ancestry.com, and there's loads of these websites, they must be under some sort of data protection act. However, I do think if you are sending your DNA off to a website, you should know that means that your DNA is up for grabs.
Basically, don't give anyone your DNA, because I just think it falling into the hands of government institutions, people that aren't to be trusted, anything like that, you don't know what could happen. You could land yourself in court or in jail for having sent your DNA away. We don't want to freak people out. Obviously, it's a fun thing to do. I get why people do it. But I do think that the fewer places your DNA is, probably the better. Not to be totally conspiracy-minded about this, but there are actual evidence cases of this. And the thing with things like familial DNA testing, why that is allowed to happen is because once an organization like Ancestry.com or whatever gets hold, and you know, we're not just going to keep talking about them, there's loads of these websites and loads of these organizations that do this. Once they have your information, they make it publicly searchable. That's the whole point. And law enforcement can also access that database.
I sent my DNA off this week.
Uh-oh.
Not to Ancestry.com.
Me too.
I joined the bone marrow register.
Well, that's like a good thing. And that's legit. I think that's legit.
Yeah, it still means my DNA is on a file. No. I think it's in Peep Show when like Jez is like, I'm not giving a sperm sample, they'll all come for me.
Then they've got you. Yeah. No, but I feel like things like maybe the NHS, that would be secure, because it's not being publicly searchable for a reason. The reason Ancestry.com would make you publicly searchable is because the point is that people are trying to track their ancestry.
Yeah, I get that.
Whereas in this, the NHS would control if it comes up as a bone marrow match. So that's fucking painful. You're going to do bone marrow.
Yeah, they don't drill into your bones anymore. They just do big needles.
I give blood. That's about it. I feel like I'm quite a useless blood type, though, because I'm like a really rare blood type, but it's at the same time I'm like, then how many people actually need this? I'm AB positive,
really?
But that basically...
Like Bruce Almighty?
Oh, was he? No, maybe that was AB negative for him, because that's the rarest. I'm AB positive, which is the second rarest. I don't know, someone tell me, I give blood regularly. How helpful am I being? Is it too rare to be worthwhile.
I think it makes it more worthwhile.
The universal, they could just take the universal one.
But I don't think bone marrow is a blood type thing. I think it's more of a genetics thing.
Yeah. So that's it. Thank you very much for listening and keep doing what you're doing and we'll do the same. So until next time.
And you can follow us on all of the social medias at Red Handed the Pod and we will see you next week.
Bye.